open the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources for Thursday, January 29th, and today is sort of air quality day. You'll see a theme here. So hopefully we'll have some good discussions about some of the bills that are coming forward today from the Department of Environmental Quality. We're going to first start off with a hearing on Senate Bill 102. So with that, I will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 102. And Beth, if you can give us a brief overview.
Senate Bill 102 extends air quality provisions relating to emissions from wood stoves to solid fuel burning device. It expands the definition to include any device that burns wood, coal, or other non-gases or non-liquid fuels. Prohibits burning certain materials in solid fuel burning device. Also renames the Residential Wood Heating Air Quality Improvement Fund to the Residential Solid Fuel Heating Air Quality Improvement Fund and modifies certain aspects of that fund. Would prohibit the sale of newer used solid fuel burning devices that do not meet certification standards. Beginning August 1st, 2010, uncertified devices would have to be removed upon the sale of a residence. Authorizes the Environmental Quality Commission to adopt rules in the Department of Environmental Quality to implement and enforce a program to curtail residential solid fuel heating during periods of air stagnation if a local government has not met the requirement under the Clean Air Act.
Okay, great. Thank you, Beth. With that, we'll invite Andy Ginsberg from the Department of Environmental Quality to come up and introduce the bill. And just a reminder, state your name for the record. Thanks, Andy. I know we saw this bill last session, so I think you're going to tell us about what's new, what's the same, how it's different. I know you've been working on it during the interim, so if you can update the committee, that would be helpful.
Okay, well, thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Andy Ginsberg, and I'm the Air Quality Administrator with DEQ, and with me is Rachel Sakata, who is an Air Quality Planner at DEQ, and we're here to provide information and to urge your support for Senate Bill 102, which we call Heat Smart for Clean Air. As you just heard, this bill would accelerate the turnover of older uncertified stoves, which is necessary to protect public health. And it would authorize the Environmental Quality Commission to set standards for new wood stoves where those stoves may be exempt from federal regulation. And limits materials that can be burned indoors, prohibits materials that currently can't be burned outdoors from being burned inside, for example, in a fireplace or in a wood stove. You should have some handouts. If I could ask you to refer to the pie chart, and that will show you the relative emissions from wood combustion and other types of emission sources. And this is an inventory, a typical inventory in an area that wouldn't be meeting the federal standard for fine particulate. And you can see that residential wood combustion dominates the inventory. It's the largest source when you have a violation of the air quality standard. And that's because on those types of days, it tends to be in the winter. And it tends to be on a day when the air is stagnated. And so there's not a lot of pollution coming in from outside of the community. Most of the pollution is being generated inside. It's a very cold day, and people are burning their wood stoves. And then the pollution builds up, and that's when we get an exceedance of the federal standard. Fine particulate we're very concerned about because the particles are so small they can get deep into your lungs where it can cause various respiratory and cardiovascular illnesses. And also the particles contain toxic organic compounds that can cause cancer. And I should also note, because of all the interest this session in climate change, that that wood stoves also generate carbon dioxide, and certified stoves produce a lot less carbon dioxide than uncertified stoves for the same amount of heat. If I could draw your attention to the second chart, which is the one with all the bars on it, that shows the areas of the state that are violating or close to violating the federal standard for fine particulate. The federal government, EPA, tightened the standard for fine particulate in 2006, and as you can see, we have the two darkest bars, Oak Ridge and Klamath Falls, are currently officially designated as non-attainment areas, and again, residential wood heating is a big part of the problem there. We also have three other areas, the three bars that have the stars on them. Those we expect will be officially designated non-attainment, but we don't have 3 years of monitoring data yet, and that's what it takes to get a formal designation. But all indications are that when we have 3 years of data, we'll have three more non-attainment areas. And then you can see that Burns and Eugene Springfield area are just under the standard, Medford a little bit lower than that. So throughout the state, we've got areas that are violating the fine particulate standard or close to violating the standard, and that's why getting ahead of the problem and addressing the problem where we have it is so critical. And then finally, if you could look at the last handout, you can see the one that looks like this. You can see the difference between the emissions from a certified stove, which is the second bar, and an EPA-certified stove. They're much cleaner. In fact, the certified stove has 70% less particulate emissions. The uncertified stove will have 25% more benzene emissions, and the chair will remember from last session when we worked on benzene, and 50% more greenhouse gas emissions. So that by moving from an uncertified stove to a certified stove, we can address multiple air quality problems at the same time. And what we'd like to do is accelerate the turnover. There are currently some 300,000 wood stoves that are in Oregon. About half of them are still uncertified, and that's because these stoves last for a really long time. So the idea in this bill would be to encourage the removal of the uncertified stoves when the home turns over. So over time, we'll replace the uncertified stoves with certified stoves. Already in Oregon, a number of local governments have required this. We've got Bend, Medford, Ashland, Lakeview, Jackson County, Klamath County have all adopted ordinances requiring the removal of uncertified stoves when a home sale occurs. And what Senate Bill 102 would do is essentially replace the local ordinances with a uniform statewide requirement. That's preferable, and I think you'll hear from the real estate industry that it's simpler for them to have one uniform requirement. We have in this bill a uniform amendment to the paperwork that's filled out upon sale of home, and that's simpler than having a different form filled out in each community. So removing a stove upon sale of home is the best time to do it because it's minimizes the impact on everyone if it's done at that time. And also it's in addition to an improvement for air quality, it's a benefit for fire safety because many of these older stoves were installed before the modern building codes applied to the chimney, and some of them are very unsafe installations. So the first and probably most important provision in this bill is removal upon sale of a home. Second provision has to do with exempt stoves. When EPA started certifying stoves about 20 years ago, a few types of stoves were exempt. Now there are some 200 types of stoves that are exempt. It's essentially a loophole. You can build a stove that just falls right outside of the definition of officially what a wood stove is, and then you're not subject to the federal requirement. So Senate Bill 102 would authorize the Environmental Quality Commission to set standards for those exempt stoves. And probably the most important category are outside wood-fired boilers, which are essentially a large boiler that's used to heat water, which is in an outside building, like a shed. And the water is then circulated into the home to heat the home. These stoves don't get very hot, so they're very, very smoky, and they're not subject to federal standards. The Northeast states have already developed a model rule, which has been adopted in some states, to address this. EPA is working on a regulation, but there isn't one now. So before very many of these are built in Oregon, we would like to set a standard equal to what the other states have done.
I just want to get something on the record. So what you're saying, there are some areas where the EPA have exempted based on their rules, but there's not a preemption keeping the states from being able to regulate those areas?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Pruszynski, that's exactly right.
Okay.
Thank you for that clarification.
One difference, Madam Chair, from the bill this year as compared to the bill we had last year is that the bill this time authorizes the commission, the Environmental Quality Commission, to set standards that are tighter than EPA's, even if EPA has already adopted a certification requirement for a certain type of stove. The reason for that is that, as I mentioned earlier, EPA standards are now 20 years old, and in some cases the stoves can be built that are cleaner than the federal standards. The state of Washington has adopted more stringent standards, and so we know there are stoves out there that can beat EPA standards. We're very hopeful that EPA will update their standards. They have indicated to us that they're starting to work on it. A number of states have asked them to, but we haven't seen them do it yet. So Senate Bill 102 would authorize the commission to adopt stricter standards, even where there is an EPA standard, but our intent would be to only do that if EPA doesn't move forward.
Okay. Do you want to keep going? You have a couple more items, or
And
more questions.
The other part of the bill would prohibit, as you heard, would prohibit the burning of certain toxic materials such as trash and plastics and treated wood and other materials that result in toxic air pollution. Those currently can't be burned outside in a burn barrel or a burn pile, but there's a loophole in Oregon law that would allow those types of materials, for example, to be burned in your fireplace. And so this bill would just make the rules for outside burning consistent with the rules for inside burning. And another difference from the bill from last session, last time we had a grant program. The idea would be that we would have some funds to especially help low-income people or people who live in an area that's violating the federal standards to replace their existing stoves. Unfortunately, with the economy the way it is right now, it's just not possible to establish a grant program. But we do have an existing incentive program that the Oregon Department of Energy operates under the Residential Energy Tax Credit. You can get a $300 tax credit if you put in a premium efficiency wood burning device. So there is some incentive. We're hopeful that in a future legislative session, when the economy has recovered, that we could establish a grant program here. But this bill does not have a grant program in it. Finally, I just want to mention that we will have a few technical amendments to this bill to clarify some of the exemptions, and I can explain those if you'd like, or we can go through those when we bring them back when you have a work session. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Okay. If you can, just very quickly mention the amendments, because I think that would be helpful.
Okay.
Yeah.
So just really briefly, we have a definition of an exemption for a central wood-fired furnace. Most wood heating devices are just a standalone stove, but in a few cases, someone may have a central heating system that burns wood. That would be extremely expensive to remove and replace, and so the bill currently exempts those, but the exemption would improve the definition of a central wood-fired furnace, so that it'd be more clear exactly what we're talking about. The same thing with a fireplace or a masonry heater. So they would just be clarifications of what the definition of those things are. Also, for the prohibition on burning toxic materials inside, the way the bill is currently written, it doesn't list all the possible places you might burn something, and so we just wanted to clarify that and make sure that we didn't leave a loophole in our plugging of a loophole.
Okay, great. Thank you, Andy. Plugging your loophole. Any questions for the department, Andy? Brian, you're looking like you might know Senator Boquist.
Why don't we let Senator Haas start first, since my list is pretty long, Madam Chair.
I guess... First, on the, I guess I agree with not burning certain things, but how is there going to be a fireplace, wood stove, police? I mean, how do you prevent?
They haven't visited your house yet.
The Christmas Day gift wrapping paper in the fireplace has always been a tradition at our house, I think, and other houses too. But there's also
this is on the record, you know.
Yeah, I know. And,
tradition at our house too, Madam Chair. So we'll be bipartisan here.
And so,
house to get rid of that stuff.
How do you enforce that, I guess, is the first
Madam
question.
Chair, Senator Haas, our intent would to enforce that upon complaints. We do occasionally get a complaint from a neighbor that will say, my next-door neighbor is burning toxic materials that are in their fireplace and it's putting out a terrible fumes. Currently, a DEQ inspector can come to the home and ask the individual to stop burning it. This would just authorize them to require the individual to stop burning it. So it would be purely a complaint response program. And I should also add an educational program. We work with many local governments on wood stove programs, and there's quite an educational outreach about how to properly season your wood and how to properly burn a fireplace to minimize smoke, and we would add in that information about what not to burn in a fireplace or a wood stove.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair.
Follow-up?
Well, the phrase treated wood, I understand what that means in construction and deck, too, but some of us who store firewood, there's a different meaning for cured wood, too. And I just, as a comment, can you walk me through the sale thing, which I think is a big part of this? If I'm selling a home and I have a non-certified wood stove, then what are the requirements put upon me, the seller, or those on the buyer, and how would that work in layman's terms?
Okay. Madam Chair, Senator Haas, the process would be this, that first your realtor would notify you of the requirement. The form that the realtors have has you look to see whether there's an EPA label on your stove. And so upon selling the home, the responsibility is on the seller to identify if they have an uncertified stove in the home. Certain stoves are exempt. For example, we were talking about a central heating stove or an antique stove would also be exempt. So on our website and in other materials, we'll have a list of what's exempt. If your stove is exempt, you'll be able to submit that information to DEQ. If it's not exempt, then the seller has to remove the stove prior to the sale and then send a notification, hopefully over our website, that it has been removed, unless the seller negotiates with the buyer, that it's the buyer's responsibility. So that's between them and in their negotiation. If the buyer accepts responsibility, then the buyer has to remove the stove within 30 days of taking possession of the home and then send us a notification that it's been done.
Follow-up. It just raised a little bit of a red flag because of the questions is, what if they don't do that, then what? How does that affect title or liens or whatever? And two, you know, there was this monstrous problem for 10 or 20 years over oil tanks, and it reminded me of that and decommissioning. And, you know, are we essentially decommissioning these wood stoves, and is there a need for certificates and paperwork?
Madam Chair, Senator Haas, we have a specific provision in the bill that says that a failure to remove the stove does not invalidate the transaction. So that came up as a question last session, and it's been incorporated into the bill. So it would be a separate civil penalty matter if DEQ was aware that the stove had not been removed as it was required to be removed, then we would issue a warning letter, and hopefully that would cause the stove to be removed. And if not, then theoretically we could impose a civil penalty for that. In terms of decommissioning the stove, there will be a number of options available. That when the stove is removed, it can be taken to a recycling center. And we're hoping that you'll be able to take it to a wood stove dealer. We've been working with the dealers, and I think they're interested in accepting the old stoves. They'll provide you with a certificate that says the stove has been destroyed, and then we'll have an arrangement with them that they'll either drill holes through the stove or they'll weld it closed and then take it for recycling.
And we do have the realtors assigned up along with the wood stove folks, so I think we'll be able to hear from them directly. Senator Boquist?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of quick questions, and then they can follow up with some information. I am interested in more information in regards to protecting public health and the medical science behind it, since I sat on Ag and Natural Resources in the House, and we heard this in the field burning side, and it was hard to clarify. So if you could follow up, I know you don't have it now, follow up with that. The second thing, I'm a little curious as to, I mean, you've pointed out you can't afford a grant program. You've written a grant program in here, and these lean economic times for government can't afford that. You indicate in your testimony, wintertime residential wood burning is a significant source of air pollution, and I would have to agree with you. And if you look at your chart you have here, I would say the hardest hit economic communities we have in the state are right here. And so I'm not sure how your communities are going to respond and how to do this. So can you kind of outline what is the economic impact on communities that you're anticipating, or was that considered?
Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, absolutely that was considered. And one of the consequences of violating the federal air quality standards is that it makes economic development more difficult. The Clean Air Act makes it much more difficult to locate new industrial facilities in an area that's violating the federal standards. So all of our communities that are violating the standards are very much interested in getting back into attainment as quickly as possible. As, for example, in Klamath Falls, if you were to try to locate a new industrial facility in Klamath Falls today, the facility would have to put on the most expensive air pollution control and would have to find other emission reductions to be made in the community to offset the increases that they're going to cause. That makes it really tough for a new business to locate, and they're likely to look elsewhere. So these areas that are violating the standards really are motivated to come back into compliance as quickly as possible. The best way to do that is to reduce wood stove emissions. So the community, that's why, for example, Klamath Falls adopted an ordinance that does almost the same thing that Senate Bill 102 does, to require removal upon sale of home. So they're very interested in getting control of the wood stove emissions, because not doing that makes it their economic development much more difficult. In terms of the grant program, the bill has within it the structure for a grant program, but there's no funding in it. So if we're able to get any federal grants, for example, from the economic stimulus package, we will have a structure to accept it. We'll be able to provide grants, but we have no funding for it right now, so we can't provide that. But the bill does not require the local governments to do any work unless they choose to. And I will just repeat that the ones that are not a team are very motivated and are taking action.
Follow up,
Madam Chair, if you'd be kind enough to provide me a copy of that economic development study and economic analysis, I'd appreciate it in regards to this bill. And then a comment, Madam Chair. I mean, I'm quite familiar with economic development, and you know, small businesses are having a challenge right now, and I think the individuals that are burning wood in their stove are having a challenge just surviving today too. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Yes,
I want to follow
up.
What Senator Haas asked, and Andy, your response was regarding enforcement, that if someone was non-compliant, that some type of citation could be issued. Who would that citation be issued to? The new owner or the seller, or both?
Madam Chair, Senator Brzezinski, first of all, I don't want to overstate this, because when it comes to violations of this nature where it's an individual, DEQ tends to utilize a technical assistance approach and an educational approach, and so we would be not all that likely to issue a violation. If we did, we would have a penalty schedule that would take into account we're talking about homeowners and not large businesses. But the requirement is for the seller to remove the stove. Unless there's a contractual agreement between the buyer and seller, then it becomes the buyer's responsibility.
Okay, thank you.
One quick question, Madam Chair, just a follow-up. I'm familiar with when there's a no-burn day, the Department of Forestry is the individual issuing the citation. In this case, which agency would be issuing the citation?
Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, for a no-burn day is a little bit different issue than what we're talking about here with this bill. That's no-burn days for wood stoves would be what we call a wood stove curtailment day. It's a similar idea with forestry burning, but if we have an inversion and we expect that, for example, in Klamath Falls, we're going to exceed the standard, then we'll call a no-burn day. And if you have another source of heat besides your wood stove, then you're not allowed to burn a wood stove on a wood stove curtailment day. Those programs are implemented by the local governments. DEQ doesn't have any programs like that, although we have the authority to do a backup program if the local government fails to implement it. But in all cases right now, the wood stove curtailment programs are run by the local governments. Some of them have surveillance programs where they will go and look to see if there's smoke coming out of a chimney on a curtailment day. And I believe that they all use an assistance-type approach. I don't think there are a lot of penalties and citations, but it's more of a knock on the door, we've got a curtailment day going on. Type of approach.
Okay. Any other questions?
All self-creations for later, Madam Chair.
Okay. Yeah, Senator Atkinson.
Thank you very much. Apologize for being tardy. I remember quite a bit of the work that we did last session on all of this. On page 2 of the bill, section 3, until the new language, until the Environmental Quality Commission adopts first adopts rules pursuant to
that ORS. And then on the first page, line 23, we mentioned the Environmental Protection Agency. Is the DEQ trying to create a rule that is stricter than the EPA?
Madam Chair, Senator Atkinson.
I don't know if that's already been asked.
It has, but it's okay.
We discussed
worth
that
repeating.
Already.
Right. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Sort of. It is a little difference between the bill from this session and last session. Last session, the bill authorized the commission to set certification standards for stoves that were exempt from EPA's program. So there are some 200 different types of stoves that technically are not wood stoves, so they don't fall under EPA's program, but they really are used like wood stoves. And last session's bill would have allowed the commission to set standards. This session, we also added the ability to become more stringent on a stove that EPA has already regulated, because EPA's standards are over 20 years old now. And, for example, the state of Washington has more stringent standards, so there are stoves that can do better. If we're going to be asking people to remove their stoves upon sale of home, and then they'll be replacing them with a new stove, we don't want to continue the problem by having them put in a stove that's not, you know, the cleanest it can be today. Now, in discussing this with the wood stove dealers, the dealers would have encouraged us to stay consistent with EPA's regulations, if at all possible, and we've committed to do that. EPA is considering updating their standards, and if they update their standards, then we won't adopt additional standards. If they don't update their standards, we may adopt additional standards, but we'll be as consistent as we can with, for example, the state of Washington. So the idea would be this is a backup authority, and our preferred approach would be if EPA will update their standards, and we believe they probably will.
Okay. Sorry, thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for the department? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, we're going to hear from some industry representatives. I'm going to call up together John Frankel, Fred Kirkpatrick, and Harvey Gale. And if you could please state your name for the record. If you have handouts, you can give them to Natalie over here. And just a reminder, we ask folks not to read your testimony and summarize it. If you have a handout, that would be great. Thank you for coming today.
Chair Dean Felder and members of the committee, thanks for inviting us. My name is Harvey Gale, for the record. I am the executive director of the Oregon Hearth, Patio, and Barbecue Association. And on my right is Fred Kirkpatrick. He is our liaison from the Northwest region of the U.S. to the National Hearth, Patio, and Barbecue Association. And on my left is John Frankel. He's the president of the Oregon Hearth, Patio, and Barbecue Association. Hearth products represent things like wood, pellet, and gas stoves and inserts, and chimney products and things like that. And these gentlemen are in retail stores that sell and service and install those appliances. So I'll go ahead and have John start here.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Dingfelder, Vice Chairman Atkinson, Senators Brzezinski, Haas, and Boquist. For the record, my name is John Frankel. Sorry, did I miss a name? Okay, sorry.
No.
As president of the Oregon Hearth, Patio, Barbecue Association, I'm here to urge your support for Senate Bill 102. And our industry support of the legislation focuses on three main areas: public health, safety, and support for renewable energy. First of all, this legislation improves public health. Enforcement of this bill removes the dirty burning uncertified wood stoves from Oregon's airshed. Why is that important, and why would we focus only on the uncertified wood stoves? Uncertified wood stoves, or those stoves that are manufactured prior to 1990 that have not been labeled as EPA compliant, are a major source of pollutant that's known as PM2.5. EPA classifies six common pollutants: ozone, carbon monoxide, nitrogen dioxide, sulfur dioxide, lead, and particulate matter, or particulate matter. The particulate matter pollution, known as fine particles, are found in smoke and haze and are 2.5 microns or smaller in diameter. In comparison, a human hair is about 70 microns in diameter, so they're very small. This category is referred to as PM2.5 and represents a serious health hazard. The smallest particles are indeed the most dangerous. Larger pollution particles deposit in the upper respiratory tract, while the smaller particles penetrate deep in the lungs, where they cause the greatest damage. PM2.5 is a threat to any Oregonian, especially children and the elderly. passage of this bill will eliminate a known danger to people with bronchitis, respiratory problems, asthma, and other lung diseases. So why focus only on uncertified stoves? An uncertified stove produces 30 to 40 grams of fine particles per hour. A certified wood stove produces 2 to 7 grams per hour. So a certified stove is up to 7 times more effective in reducing emissions. Uncertified stoves are a major source of PM2.5 in Oregon. In 2002, the DEQ estimated that wood stoves produced 7,400 tons per year of fine particulate matter. And elimination of non-certified stoves could reduce the PM2.5 levels in the order of tons. My second point, passage of this legislation would improve public safety. Removal of uncertified stoves will improve fire safety in homes. Non-EPA certified stoves and the venting associated with them have a usable lifespan of about 20 years, according to manufacturers. So those stoves are reaching the end of their normal lifetime. Installers in our industry have seen that components of the venting installed prior to 1990 have degraded prior to continual use, higher internal temperatures, and possible poor maintenance. Technology in the stove industry, particularly in venting, has improved considerably since then. Removal of the stoves reduces a fire hazard. Related benefit is possible lower insurance rates as uncertified stoves are taken out of the market. My third point, that legislation should be viewed as an overall effort to promote renewable energy. When a stove is removed, the consumer can have a variety of options. He or she can choose to have no device and rely on central heating. Many will choose clean-burning natural gas appliances, but many will choose to remain with clean-burning EPA-certified wood or pellet stoves that utilize a renewable energy source that is grown and harvested here in Oregon. And most wood and pellet stoves sold in Oregon qualify for the Oregon Residential Energy Tax Credit of up to $300. So why does the hearth industry specifically support this? Well, the bill appropriately places the regulatory focus on uncertified stoves. We believe it is important to remove the burden of the dirty burning stoves from the environment in order to ensure that all wood and pellet stoves are not inappropriately regulated or banned. It would be unwise of me to ignore what may appear to be this self-serving aspect of this legislation. The hearth and retail industry, particularly installers, are made up of mostly small businesses throughout Oregon. We recognize that they would benefit from the lift in sales and revenue and the employment as consumers change out their stoves. We do have concerns about the fact that there is not a grant program associated with this, that indeed we're encouraged that there is a funding basket that started and that there could be efforts to place funds in those baskets for a grant program. We also have concerns about the EQC rulemaking, which Fred Kirkpatrick will address. But in summary, although we have recommendations about the revisions in this bill, the hearth industry strongly recommends passage of SB 102.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Why don't we hear from you, and then we'll take questions for the whole panel.
Okay. My name is Fred Kirkpatrick. I own a hearth store in Portland, and I've been in this industry ever since I was 22 years old, so I guess I'm an old-timer. I'm going to pass over a lot of the stuff that's already been discussed and, you know, to try to conserve some time. I'm going to move right into the into my perceived concerns and shortcomings on this bill that I see. First, I can't support the portion of the bill that grants the Environmental Quality Commission full authority to adopt new standards for residential pellet stoves or any other residential alternative energy biomass consuming products. EPA already has existing standards for many of these products and will soon be opening the new source performance standard up for review. They've already notified our industry, not officially yet, but in private discussions with them, they've notified the Hearth Products Association that they intend to open up the new force, new source performance standard this year. It's anticipated that the new review process will address most of the shortcomings that DEQ and other states' environmental regulations or regulators have with the existing new source performance standard, which was adopted nearly 17 years ago in 1992. With declining revenue and budget dollars growing ever so difficult to obtain, I'm of the opinion that our citizens' tax dollars could be spent much more effectively elsewhere. I'd further suggest that it would be unnecessary and fiscally irresponsible for EQC and DEQ to attempt to undertake such a burdensome task as creating, implementing, and administering these new standards. This is clearly an EPA task. The second problem I have with it is that the bill does not address DEQ's role in enforcement of current laws or education for consumers. It is now and has been since 1992 illegal for anyone to sell or advertise for sale a non-compliant wood stove. Those are in the Oregon administrative rules. Yet on any given day in any city in Oregon, I can open up a newspaper, classified ads, or go to Craigslist.com and find a number of illegal stoves being advertised for sale. I copied this yesterday from Craigslist.com. There's 11 wood stoves. This is in Portland. Covers 7 days worth of advertising. There's 11 wood stoves on here for sale. And out of these 11 wood stoves, 8 of them are illegal. Those illegal stoves, if we could replace those illegal stoves with legal stoves, we could see reductions, individual stack reductions of the percentages vary according to whose figures you use, but it's huge. So my suggestion is that we get together, someone gets together with DEQ, and that we come up with a solution for enforcement and education of our citizens, because you can pass all the bills you want, and if the consumers don't know about it, and if there's no one there to enforce them, we're just going to keep going around in circles and wondering why we get dizzy all the time.
Okay. Any other points to add?
I wanted to touch a bit on the economic advantages of pellet stoves. There's 7 pellet mills in Oregon, and these pellet mills make. I'm sure does everybody know what pellets are? They're processed wood waste that are burned in stoves. 3 or 4 of those mills also make fire logs to burn in wood stoves. It's a little known fact that these 7 mills together produce the equivalent energy content of about half the annual output of the Bonneville Dam. So it is a huge industry, and I just recommend that we tread lightly when trying to regulate beyond EPA's scope the ability of these stoves to be sold and used in our state. In closing, I'd just like to say that with amendments that deal with the EQC issues and the enforcement and education part of it, I could and would support this bill. So I take any questions.
Thank you. Thank you all. Any questions for the panel? Okay, Senator Boquist? Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could one of you address just some historical data for me so that when I get the economic impact statement from DEQ, would you briefly cover the types of stoves that you sell? And I heard made mention of gas or wood and electric that may be sold by one of the organizations. And the second thing, just a rough estimate on the average cost of installation, for example, a certified wood stove properly put into a home of, I don't know, 2,000 square foot, we'll say, or 2,500 square foot as a bounce. What's the average cost to have that done in terms of a wood stove? I know some of the organizations here sell gas stoves, so on and so forth. I'm looking for a replacement cost, and we'll say 2,500 square foot home.
2,500 square foot home, a good quality wood stove that would last a consumer pretty much a lifetime. Depending on whether chimney was present or if it needed chimney, let's assume that they're going to do the whole thing. It's going to run somewhere between $3,000 and $4,000 installed, building permits, chimney, floor pad, everything. Very similar for a pellet stove, similar similar cost, maybe slightly less for a natural gas product.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Senator Hess.
Thank you. As was noted, if something like this were to pass, you would be selling more of your products. Would you then be willing, then, on the disposal issue, to take back old wood stoves and bear the responsibility of getting rid of these things in a safe environmental way?
We currently do that. When obviously we look at the stoves that we take in, if they're a compliant stove that meet the requirements, and if they're in good enough shape, then we'll refurb them a bit and resell them. If they're illegal, we take the doors off. We smash the controls on them, so there's no ability to control them, and we pretty much give them to metal recyclers when they come around. So, and I know that most of my fellow dealers do similar. Most of them will take the stoves and make sure that they're destroyed.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? All right. Thank you, gentlemen. Certainly appreciate your input. Okay. Last up, we have Dana Kay from the American Lung Association, Timothy Seaton, and Jana Jarvis. I'll just have you all come up just for the sake of time. This is not a panel, and just a reminder to state your name for the record.
$620 million market.
Combined features.
Dana, why don't you go ahead?
Did you say me? I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks. Madam Chair and Committee, my name is Dana Kay, and I represent the American Lung Association in Oregon. It's our mission to save lives by improving health, lung health, and preventing lung disease. Senate Bill 102 would play a significant part in helping helping us achieve our mission in Oregon. I'm not going to go over some of the interesting information that you've already heard about particulate matter, but I will point out that some people are very much more susceptible than others, and that are people that have heart disease or lung disease, such as congestive heart failure, angina, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, emphysema, and asthma. They experience the effects of a wood stove earlier and at much lower levels than healthy people. Older adults are more likely to be affected by smoke, possibly because they more likely have a chronic heart disease or other conditions more so than the younger people. And children are also very susceptible to smoke for several reasons. Their respiratory systems are still developing. They breathe in more air and air pollution per pound of body weight than adults, and they're more likely to become active outside. With energy costs at all-time high, we are concerned about the potential impact of increased reliance on wood burning, particularly the use of wood stoves, that the impacts might have on both the environment and the families who rely primarily on this method of home heating. The wood stove changeout program would take into effect the most efficient method of replacement, and so we wouldn't want to put families at a higher risk by changing out to a more expensive product, for instance, or something that would cost them more money. But what we were hoping is that the replacement would be a high-efficiency wood stove. If people have a source of wood stove wood nearby, if they're living at the coast and somewhere where wood is an easy product for them to get, or if they're closer to natural gas, they could change out that way. I'm actually very hopeful, too, that we might see the grant process be put back into the law, because I think that would really make a difference. We've done the numbers on that, and I think we could really help a lot of Oregonians with just a small amount of money. I know also that wood stoves, we have some numbers on the back of my testimony. You can see that since across the nation, we have about 35 other change-out programs, and so far we see about 7,500 number of wood stoves that have been replaced, 196 tons of particulate matter, which are avoided each and every year by those replacements, and we could save $102 million, and that's in prevention things. So we're preventing the asthma attacks, we're preventing the heart attacks and the early deaths. So I really urge you to support this bill. I think it would be good for the health of our organs.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kay. Any questions for Ms. Kay? Senator Boquist?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I missed the savings of $102 million was on what again, ma'am?
Madam Chair, Senator Boquist. It's the health effects, the emission reductions would achieve each year, just with, it's actually what they're achieving with the results that they've seen so far. And it's because you would prevent the asthma attacks, you'd prevent the kids from going to the hospital with an asthma attack. We see a lot of non-fatal heart attacks from wood stove, just the smoke itself. So you'd see a prevention, and these are of the 35 programs that are already in place across the country.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Any other questions, Ms. Kinney? Okay, next, actually, Mr. Seaton, since you signed up first, why don't you go ahead?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senators. I'm Timothy Seaton. I'm a third-generation masonry contractor from about 12 miles from here, actually. I started at the age of 5. You probably walked across some of my masonry as you came in. I build masonry heaters. It's the oddball thing that's mentioned here for the first time for emissions in the state of Oregon. You probably don't even know what it is. If you do, it's like a site-built fireplace. It's usually built on site. It's made of masonry. It costs lots of money. We don't build a lot of them. But what it does differently than a fireplace is it burns very cleanly, and it provides a lot of heat. The emissions numbers we have for them, and we've done quite a bit of testing in conjunction with the EPA, is it's comparable to a pellet stove and cleaner than a wood stove. And I'm not either supporting this bill or opposing it. I'll point out two things. One, which is really a technical matter and can probably be dealt with the folks from DEQ, is that there is a standards definition of a masonry heater. It's in the ASTM standards organization, particularly it's E1602. I'm a secretary of that task group that does define masonry heaters. It is referenced in the International Residential Code in the building code side, and it's a little bit more specific than the one that's used here. It would eliminate some confusion. The second thing I would be concerned about is, because this is the first attempt to address the emissions issue for site-built masonry heaters, we found in the past that to say certify emissions is a problem for a site-built device. A typical test costs somewhere in the order of $10,000 to $17,000. I've run those numbers. And you're building a one-of-a-kind unit. So as soon as you mention the words certify emissions or the DEQ coming up with emissions, you're creating a severe problem for my industry, in that we can't spend that much money on every one we build for a customer. And again, I'm not sure the solution to that. It maybe we talk about that when the regulations are set, but it is a concern for me.
Well, thank you. Appreciate you bringing those concerns to the committee today. Questions?
Okay. I do.
I was going to say, you look like you had one, Senator.
Where would I see one of these?
Where would you see one? If you could talk to me later, I can actually give you some of my customers within a few miles. They're typically in residential homes. I don't know of any commercial buildings near here. They're typically built in new construction. Sometimes we do them in residential remodeling. Typically, they're space heaters. I would like to be able to give you a 2,500-square-foot home and heat it for $3,000 to $4,000 installation, but for one of my products, it would be $15,000 to $25,000. So it's like a fireplace that gives you serious heat. And in all of North America, we believe there are about 600 to 1,000 a year going in. It's just not a big regulatory burden. Hmm. We would rather be ignored as builders and let us do what we do, except that when you certify and regulate emissions, all of a sudden we get roped in. And if you say that we're exempt, which we were, incidentally, in the original New Source Performance Standards, they just said they're not a problem, we're going to exempt them. But then when you say, okay, we can only install certified devices, suddenly we've been written out. Within 25 miles here, I would suspect that there are probably about 100 to 150.
Is
no
a
more.
Firebox larger than an average fireplace?
A typical firebox on a masonry heater that's a large one would be about half the size of a typical fireplace.
Uh-huh. Are they lined with soapstone?
There is one large company from Finland that has a soap. It's the fourth largest stone company in Europe. Their soapstone fireboxes are standard on their units. A typical one that's site built out of local materials would have firebrick.
Well, you may have a new customer here, so you might have to talk to him outside on the.
He's going upstairs in the governor's office.
They are wonderful. My customers convinced me it was a good product. So,
great. Thank you. And are you? One last question: are you burning?
It burns standard cordwood with numbers very similar to pellet stove emissions. Very, very clean.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate you coming forward. And last but not least, we have Ms. Jarvis.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jana Jarvis, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. We worked with the department in the legislation that was put forth in 2007. We had our concerns at the time were twofold. We had members from around the state that were dealing with multiple jurisdictions and different kinds of standards, and we were interested in the development of a statewide standard. And also, since this was something that was going to happen at the point of transfer, we were interested in the process involved. And out of that came the idea to interject the questions that you see on page 13 and 14 in the bill, but we added a clarified a question and added a question to the seller's property to disclosure, and rather than create another document at the point of transfer. So we have looked through this bill. We did have a couple of questions. We've talked to the department. We'd like a little clarifying language in Section 10. They've indicated a willingness to work with us on that. But other than that, I did want you to know that we were supportive of the bill.
Great. Appreciate you coming forward. Any questions for Ms. Jarvis? Why am I a surprise? Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jana, what percentage, and I'm sure there's a document, you may not have it, but what percentage of yearly sales of homes have a wood stove?
Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, I do not have the answer to that. And I'm not quite sure how I can get you the answer, but I will certainly look for one.
DEQ
may have information.
Yeah, they may have better information than I would.
Follow up?
Yeah, I mean, considering the housing market, and I had your document brought down to me, by the way,
mm-hmm.
And I'm looking at it, and, you know, we're talking at a $620 million replacement cost minimum in the houses in the state of Oregon. I'm just trying to figure out how much per year we're going to generate in wood stove sales to make this program work. But the overall cost is $620 million at present dollar value.
Wood stove people might have some answers for you as well, so I'll ask them to talk with you in the hall afterwards. Great, thank you. Any other questions from the panel? Okay, thank you very much. Anybody else that would like to testify on this bill? Okay, so colleagues, I think that the department is going to be working on a few amendments and then coming back to us as soon as they have those, so I'll ask you to work with committee staff. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 102. Okay, and next we're going to move on to Senate Bill 103. So we'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 103. Beth, give us a summary.
Senate Bill 103 authorizes the Environmental Quality Commission to establish a schedule of fees for registration of classes of air contamination sources. It requires that the fee be based on the anticipated cost of developing and implementing programs related to the classes.
Okay. Thank you, and I think we're going to hear again from Andy Ginsberg at DEQ. Today is your day, Andy. Welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair. At least I don't have to be in the House Committee at the same time.
Yeah, we're trying to manage that.
Again, for the record, my name is Andy Ginsberg. I'm the Air Quality Administrator at DEQ, and I'm here to present information and urge your support for Senate Bill 103, which provides an alternative to air quality permitting for businesses. And let me just start by providing a little background about why we are recommending this legislation. The federal government, EPA, has been regulating hazardous air pollutant emissions since the Clean Air Act amendments of 1990 were adopted. And they began by regulating emissions from large industrial facilities, and they have now worked their way down to smaller businesses. And they're currently adopting regulations that affect 70 different categories of small businesses, such as auto body shops and metal fabricators, metal platers, dry cleaners, and many other categories of businesses. Under the normal approach, EPA adopts these regulations, and then the companies have to get a DEQ permit to comply with the regulation. And we have already taken steps to reduce the cost for small businesses. We have adopted some new lower cost permits for them. But the our Small Business Compliance Advisory Panel and the auto body shops asked if we could create a whole new approach, a different approach where they wouldn't have to get a permit at all. And that's how we started down this path. And in particular for the auto body shops, they have created a program called EcoBiz, and it's a It's a program where the auto body shops comply with all of the regulations, not just air quality, but the hazardous waste regulations and water quality regulations, by using pollution prevention and renewable practices, sustainable practices. And it's a totally voluntary program, but many auto body shops have opted into this, and they get certified that they're not only meeting all the regulations, but exceeding, you know, doing better than the regulations. And the request to us is, was, if we're EcoBiz certified, why do we need a permit? We're already meeting the regulations. So the idea would be that a small business that was subject to one of these federal regulations would just register with us and wouldn't get a permit. And if I could draw your attention, I have a handout for this bill as well. I could draw your attention to the handout. It's a little flow chart, and looks like this. And basically, it just shows that we start out with a statutory authority, and then we end up with an administrative rule. And in this case, it would be implementing a federal regulation. And there's just two different compliance paths. One path, we would issue a permit, and the other path, we would just issue a registration. A permit makes sense when you have a business that has many different regulations that apply, so you can consolidate all those different regulations into one document. It makes it simpler for them to comply. It makes it simpler for the inspector to do an inspection. We also need a permit when we've got when there's a source-specific requirement where the rule contains, for example, a process or a procedure but doesn't actually include the final limit, and that needs to be figured out, then that's done through a permit. And the permit then goes through a public comment process, and it's issued. It also provides a source of funding for the program. The permit fee is how we pay for the rule writers, the inspectors, and the technical assistance staff, and also all the reporting to EPA and the other things that are required for running the program. A registration, on the other hand, doesn't include any requirements. It just tells us who is out there that's subject to the regulation, and they comply directly with the regulation. There's no conditions in a permit to comply with. They just meet the regulation. And we would implement that by developing fact sheets and providing technical assistance. So we would visit the auto body shop, make sure they know what's required by the federal rule, and then we would periodically inspect, but we wouldn't have a permit. The problem that we have in going forth with this approach is current statute authorizes the registration, but it doesn't enable us to establish a registration fee. So there's no way for us to pay for the staff unless we issue a permit. So basically what this bill does is authorize us to charge a fee for the registration so that we can issue that in lieu of permitting. And our intent would be that the fee would always be equal to or lower than the fee that would be required if you had a permit. So it would always be a net benefit to a business. It would always be optional. You could get a permit if you wanted one. But if you wanted to be registered instead, you could be registered. And it would, as I said, it would provide the funding for our technical assistance and inspections without having a permit. So it's not a new requirement in that sense. It's an alternative and simpler way of complying with the existing requirements. So that was the genesis of the bill, and I think you'll hear today from auto shops and others who requested it, why they wanted it, and so I won't dwell on that. I do want to mention, though, that once we have a registration fee, now we have a tool that could be used for other purposes in terms of a streamlined approach. For example, we have some regulations where there are businesses that are conditionally exempt from the regulation. So if you use less than a certain amount of a product, we know your emissions are low and therefore you're exempt from the regulation. But you may have to get a permit anyway just to verify that you're using less than that amount of that product. Well, that's another case where we really wouldn't need a permit. We could just do a registration as long as you register with us and assure us that you're using less than the threshold amount, then you're exempt from the regulation. You don't need a permit. Another example that's come up is greenhouse gas emission reporting. As you, I'm sure, all know, last year the Environmental Quality Commission adopted a regulation requiring greenhouse gas emission reporting. And the only way we could fund that program today would be to require reporters to get a permit and then pay a permit fee. Through this legislation, we could instead register those who have to report, and they could pay a registration fee, and it would be a simpler process for those who wanted to use a registration instead of permitting. I just want to emphasize that This bill does not give the Environmental Quality Commission any new authority to adopt new regulations or new emission standards. For example, the commission could not adopt a new regulation that would affect a small business because of this statute, but could only establish a registration fee that could be used instead of a permit fee. And likewise, this bill would not authorize the commission to adopt new regulations for greenhouse gases, but would allow the commission to establish a fee to pay for the existing greenhouse gas reporting program. The bill does not include specific dollar amounts for the fees, and that's intentional because the fee needs to be set for each category specifically. We have many different categories of permits, and we would always want to have the registration fee be tailored for that sector so that it's equal to or less than the comparable permit fee. And those permit fees are set periodically, change from time to time, and so the registration fees would have to follow suit. But the legislature does have oversight and control over the level of these fees, and it's the same process that we use for our permit fees. That is, by setting our spending limitation and our position authority, the Ways and Means Committee, through the budget process, controls the level of these fees. In terms of support for the bill, our Small Business Compliance Advisory Panel requested it and supports it. The Northwest Automotive Trades Association supports it, and many small businesses around the state, and I think you'll hear from some of them today. And I believe you also have received a letter from Kate Marks from the Office of Regulatory Streamlining, and she has highlighted this as a regulatory streamlining approach. So, again, you know, our idea here is a simpler process than a permit. I know it looks like a new fee, but what it is really a replacement for an existing fee with a simpler process. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Great. Thank you, Andy. Questions? Okay. Senator Atkinson, I can't see you. I don't know what happened to Senator House.
Thank you. Andy, this may sound out in left field, but there's a method to it. Do beauty salons and places that do women's fingernails fall into this bill?
Senator Dinkfelder, Senator Atkinson, the existing authority to register sources covers any category of air pollutant sources that the Environmental Quality Commission might identify. So theoretically, I think the answer would have to be yes. Practically, the answer would be no. We haven't required them to register in the past. And unless there were some regulation, if EPA adopted a fingernail polish regulation and we were required to implement it and we needed funding for staff to go inspect those types of facilities, this could be a mechanism. It certainly would be preferable to issuing permits to those types of facilities, but I know of no regulation like that, and we certainly wouldn't register them without having a regulatory need.
Well, Madam Chair, this may sound silly, but I have a religious dedication to catching fish with a fly, and there's a particular fly shop that I frequent, and right next to this fly shop is one of these beauty salons, and they use the same paint as a body shop uses, acrylic paint. I mean, it's heavy-duty stuff, and the stuff gets in the HVAC system, and it either blows outside or it blows, as it did for years, into this fly shop that made about four different people sick and made even the shop dog sick. And so they called me and they said, I think that tall guy with the cane is in politics. Maybe he'll know what to do. And I didn't know if, not that I would sick the government on anybody, but I was very curious because this practice wouldn't stop and they're using the same paint as an auto body shop. So when you referenced a body shop, it made me wonder if this isn't the same place. Right now, I guess I'm not really in the market to have my nails done, but I understand there's...
Look at me.
You can pick, and this is a subcategory where people do this, but you can nearly... The odor and the fumes and the air quality in these places is not good.
Chair Dinkfelder, Senator Atkinson, Many of those types of paints contain solvents, and the solvents are probably what you're smelling. There are some national rules to reduce the hydrocarbon VOC content of those solvents, and So, you know, there are already some regulations that apply to the product manufacturer, and that would probably be the most efficient way to address a problem like this. Rather than regulate a beauty salon, you would look at the solvent content of the product itself. In many cases, they've been able to develop water-based products, or at least lower VOC content products that have less odor and less toxicity. And I could, if you're interested, I could research and see if there's any efforts along those lines. But this particular bill wouldn't affect any of that, okay. but we certainly could look into that.
I can think of four sick men that would actually like to know about that. That'd be great. Thank you.
Yeah, if you can follow up, and not to mention the workers in those shops, actually. So, any other questions? Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to ensure I understand... I understand the conceptual idea of streamlining, and what you're saying is if a permit is required presently, that this could be an alternative to a permit. If a permit is not required presently, this is the mechanism you would do to establish a regulation or restriction.
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Boquist, if we didn't have this mechanism and we needed funding to implement a regulation, we would have to issue a permit. That would be our only option now, and it would be an inefficient way of going about that if the only need was funding for inspectors, for example, because a permit creates a burden not only on the department but also on the regulated facility to to renew, issue, comply with. And it creates additional administrative burdens. And so if the need is just funding for implementing a rule, it's much, in my view, preferable to just issue a registration and collect a registration fee than to issue a permit. You're correct that if this bill were to pass and we had a new need that came along where a permit was not necessary, we would in all likelihood use a registration approach rather than a permitting approach. But again, the new need would come from other authority. This bill wouldn't give us any authority to adopt a new regulation. That would have to be something that was otherwise authorized and necessary. And if we needed new staff to implement this new program, we would have to first get permission from the Ways and Means Committee and the legislature through our budget. So we couldn't just raise revenue by issuing a registration fee without first getting permission from the legislature.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
And I'll preface it, Madam Chair. I mean, in the two sessions I've been here, and this is the third session I've been here, and I'm not talking about your department. I'm just talking in general, it's very tough to get the information that you're talking about as far as being able to provide fiscal oversight of the state as a whole. Having said that, which raises the concern, in a previous bill in which you testified, we're talking about providing the DEQ rule authority and regulatory authority kind of as they see fit. So the commission could come up with a new standard under one of these other bills, and then you could implement that standard through a registration process using this bill right here. Is that not correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, that's correct, and that would be in lieu of implementing it through a permit.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, can I also just mention briefly that we have been discussing this bill with various stakeholders, and there are some existing registration programs out there that are implemented for other programs, and our intent is not to have any overlap with those. So we're going to verify that either those programs are exempt from this, or we may need an amendment to this bill to clarify that if there's some other registration program or some other permit program that applies, that we don't have overlap. So we may bring back an amendment to this bill as well.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for Andy? Okay, thank you. We'll look forward to hearing from you some more on this bill. And in the meantime, we have several folks who would like to testify. Francis Hartwell, you can come up, please. And actually, I'm going to call folks up again just in because we are running out of time here. Mike Dykstel. Sorry if I'm not saying your name right. And then Catherine Vanetta. But why don't you go ahead, Francis, if you can start.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Frances Hartwell. My husband and I are business owners in Tillamook County, and we are former collision repair shop owners in Portland. I have been for a number of years the chair of the Small Business Compliance Advisory Panel. We're the group that recommended what we are calling the Ecobiz opt-out of the permit scenario. Just briefly, I would like to say that this gives the automotive collision repair business the opportunity to become involved in an ecological business program wherein they will change their business practices to reduce their environmental footprint. It is not a, it's likely to be an opportunity to spend more money, but it's also an opportunity to produce tangible results. In other words, it's an action that encourages meaningful change. Instead of paying a permit fee, you will change behavior that will produce an outcome that will benefit us all. And in saying that, I lend my support to this legislation because it's something that makes sense and produces measurable results. With that, I would ask you if you have any questions.
No, thank you.
Any questions?
Thank you for driving this whole way.
Yeah, thank you. We appreciate you coming and your involvement in this because I know you've worked very closely with the agency. Okay, next, Mike Dyksel.
Mike Dyksel, Director of Forest Protection for the Oregon Forest Industries Council here in Salem. Thank you for the opportunity to hear our testimony today. I'm also a member of the state's Smoke Management Advisory Committee as it relates to Chapter 477, which is the Oregon Department of Forestry burning program, so I've got some experience there. We just went through a very lengthy five-year review of the program. It's just a stellar program recognized nationally, and we brought some new rules and regulations to keep it moving into the next century. When I first read the bill, it was very broad. I couldn't get at the intent. What were they trying to fix? And in listening to Mr. Ginsburg's testimony, it becomes clear what is the focus. So I called him last night. We spoke on the phone. He understood our concerns. I think what he talked about just in his conclusion there about making some amendments to deal with some concerns where there's an overlap in registration because there are registration fees and user fees that support the Oregon Department of Forestry's program. He offered me some guidance within the DEQ rules and statutes, specifically ORS 468A.020, Section 1, which exempts agricultural operations when it comes to burning under the managed program of the Department of Agriculture, and in Section E of that same section exempts forest land burning. So once he showed me that, I was much more at ease that what the focus was and the existence of an exemption for those two kind of operations. So at that point, I was pretty much satisfied. If he's willing to introduce that as an amendment to make it a little bit clearer, we'd be ecstatic about that. The other side is, I guess, we'll remain neutral because our counterparts, I mean, that takes care of the field operations of agricultural and forestry burning, but the manufacturing side of our businesses still have some concerns. I think you'll hear those from Catherine. So at this point, we're going to remain neutral until that opportunity for their concerns to be addressed. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions?
Catherine Venata, Governmental Affairs Manager of the Northwest Pulp and Paper Association. You have my written testimony. In summary, Northwest Pulp and Paper Association members all hold air permits. We pay fees for our Title V air operating permits and also our air contaminant discharge permits. We are large fee payers on air fees in this state. Our concerns with this specific bill is that it's a broad grant of authority without any limitations, and specifically, we're asking more specificity about actual regulations that it's intended to address and the department programs that the fees would support. We would also like to know what the possible fees would be for the 2009-2011 biennium on facilities such as ours, because at this economic time, fees are of great concern to us. We already pay a lot of fees, and we're trying to figure out how this fits into the mix. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Menina? Okay. Thank you all for coming and sharing your thoughts on this bill. I think that he's going to be busy looking at some amendments, so we'll encourage you to come back to the committee when you have some amendments to present. And with that, we're going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 103 and open up the last public hearing, which is on Senate Bill 104. And Beth, if you can give us a brief summary, please.
Senate Bill 104 removes the requirement that the Environmental Quality Commission establish the fee schedule every 2 years for sources subject to the Federal Operating Permit Program under the Clean Air Act, aligns the period for determining the Consumer Price Index with the federal definition.
Okay. And we have up Catherine Bonetta once again. Shouldn't have had you sit down. And John Ledger. Andy, do you want to come up and talk about the bill? I guess I should have you come up first, but you guys can all sit there together. You're all going to be talking to each other. Sorry, Andy, how can I forget you?
I'm afraid you're going to be sick of me after today, but I guess
we got a long way to go, so don't even start.
For the record, Andy Ginsberg, Air Quality Administrator with DEQ, and I'm here to provide information about Senate Bill 104. And this would make a technical correction to a bill from last session, which was called Senate Bill 107. And that bill raised the permit fees for the Title V operating permit program. Title V is a requirement of the Federal Clean Air Act. It's Title V of the Clean Air Act, and it requires that the largest industrial facilities hold operating permits. Oregon's Title V program was adopted in 1991, and the purpose is to ensure a high level of compliance with regulations that apply to those facilities. Senate Bill 107 was adopted last session to adjust the fees for Title V. The Title V program has built into it an adjustment for inflation based on the Consumer Price Index, but that adjustment did not keep pace with our costs. And in 2007, we adopted Senate Bill 107 to raise the fees. And essentially, as a streamlining effort, as part of that bill, we changed the rule, the process, so that instead of increasing the or adjusting the fee for inflation every year, we would do it every other year. In other words, we'd save the cost of doing two rulemakings, and we'd set a two-year fee schedule. Unfortunately, we made a little mistake because the Consumer Price Index isn't published in time for us to do a two-year fee schedule. So our unintended consequences, by the time the Commission does this rulemaking, they'll only have the information to do 1 year of the two-year fee schedule, and we won't be able to really implement the original intent of that bill. So our solution has two fixes in it. First, it changes the definition of the Consumer Price Index to match the federal definition. In the Oregon law, the Consumer Price Index is basically a calendar year, January to December. And in the federal law, it's a fiscal year, September to August. So that gives us 4 extra months. The information comes out 4 months earlier, and it solves our problem. Plus, it makes our rule identical to the federal rule. The second thing is that we want to change it so that we can do more than one rulemaking in a biennium. Our intent would be normally to just do one rulemaking a biennium and set a two-year schedule, but occasionally, as in, for example, this year, we'll have to do two rulemakings to get ourselves from the old fee schedule to the new schedule, and then after that, most of the time, we'll only have to do one rulemaking. So it's a pretty simple technical fix, and the intent is really just to get the legislation from last year back to its original intent. And with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Okay. Any questions, Randy, before we hear from the witness, other witnesses? Senator Boquist.
I'll hold it, Madam Chair.
Okay. Okay. Why don't you go ahead, John? You're in the
John Ledger with Associated Oregon Industries, and this brings the bill kind of in conformance with what we all agreed to last time, so we're fine with it.
Okay. Ms. Manetta?
Catherine Venata, Governmental Affairs Manager, Northwest Pulp and Paper Association. The department did come to us during the interim and explain their mistake on the two-year issue, and it was actually one of my engineers that helped them engineer the fix to try to solve this problem. They worked with us very closely during the interim, explained the issue to us. It is something that we agreed with last session as far as a fee increase went, and we're keeping our word and we're supporting the fix. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Madam. Just make sure I understand. So what we're doing is being able to set the fee twice in a biennium?
Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, what we'll adopt the fee once a biennium normally, and it will have a two-year fee schedule in it. So it'll say, you know, for this year the fee is X, and for next year the fee is X plus the consumer price index. And so we'll do one rulemaking, but it'll have two-year fee schedule in it. But the bill would allow us to do a second rulemaking if we had to. For example, if there was an error or something that needs to be adjusted, we could do another rulemaking. But we'll always have a two-year schedule. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, thank you.
Does that clarify your question?
It does, Madam Chair, but I mean, I guess I'll look at the constitutionality outside of here.
Okay. Other questions? Okay, we appreciate your work on this, especially your engineers who helped with it. And is there anybody else at this point who would like to testify on this bill? On this bill, I'm going to reopen the other one. Did you want to, Ralph?
Yes.
Okay, so come on up.
For alibi.
Did I not sign the right sheet?
No, you signed 103. This is one. I know, I'm going to reopen the hearing. It was covered up, so we have two people that we're going to have come up on 103. Did you want to testify on this one, 104? Okay, so come on up.
All part of my.
Just want to comment on DEQ in general.
Absolutely, and for the record, my name is Ralph Saperstein. I'm representing Boise Incorporated, and I didn't come with them, which is a good thing, because I'm sort of the uncooperative stepchild on this issue, and that I really think we need a reality check in this building after 2.5 weeks. We're facing unprecedented economic times. The turmoil makes things different, and we should not consider business as usual. Rising energy costs and the economic product demand problems had led my client Boise to close their pulp mill in St. Helens, laying off 450 family wage workers. My concern is that we ought to consider some action that preserves our current jobs. Now, the Senate yesterday took action that we hope will lead to jobs in the future, but we have jobs that need to be preserved right now, and maybe what we ought to consider in terms of fees is how about a two-year moratorium on fees? They're significant for pulp and paper mills, $200,000 and plus. And maybe this would be a good thing for this legislature to do, to take an affirmative action to preserve current jobs. And we're certain that those jobs already exist. Now, I need to say that I'm not just an uncooperative stepchild. The DEQ has been very helpful, and they were very helpful to the mill in St. Helens, and they're cooperative on fees things, and we sincerely appreciate their help. But that their help wasn't enough. The rising energy prices and the recession led to having to lay off 450 workers. I think now if we do something, we might still be able to preserve the other 9 pulp and paper mills in Oregon. And as I said, the DEQ had tried, but it wasn't enough. That was too little to make to deal with the tsunami of the economic recession.
Sorry.
So all I wanted to do, and the reason why it's not pertinent to the 104, and I wanted to say it on 103, is that maybe we ought to look at doing something like a temporary moratorium on fees so we can keep our existing jobs in Oregon.
Great. Thank you for your comments. Appreciate it. Any questions?
I ran him right out of the
room. I guess you did. Scared off one of my members. Okay. Anybody else who would like to testify on Senate Bill 104? Okay, with that, I would close the public hearing on Senate Bill 104. And with an unfortunate oversight, I missed somebody on Senate Bill 103 because the sheet was covered up. So I'm hoping that Bob Anderson and Daryl Fuller will allow me to reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 103. I'm going to reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 103 so we can get your comments for the record. And I apologize, gentlemen. It was clearly an oversight, no reflection at all on either of you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. I almost took that opportunity to leave the building as quickly as I could and save myself some time and save you guys some time. But Daryl Fuller for the Northwest Auto Trades Association, an association who represents some mechanical and collision repair shops, auto dealers, and other people that work in the automotive industry. And we're here to express our support on Senate Bill 103 and to express our appreciation to Andy Ginsberg and to DEQ for their business-friendly attitude and their great customer service skills. I've had a chance over the last 15 years or so to work with DEQ fairly closely on a number of pieces of legislation, administrative rules, and have always found them to be one of the best agencies to work with when it comes to thinking outside the box, to use an old cliche. And I'll describe a brief example that sort of fits into what we're doing here that had made such an impact on an industry that I'd worked with that it sticks in my mind, and that's with car dealers. When the license plates on a used car in a car lot expire, we can't sell that car without a current DEQ certification if it's in a DEQ certification area. And so the car dealers were having to drive these cars to the nearest DEQ test station, have them tested, and then bring them back to sell them for the customer. And so that took staff time to get the vehicles to the test stations and back. It put the cars on the road, usually during peak business hours, which is during the day. And I remember, because I had the conversation with Mr. Ginsberg in the coffee shop here in the basement, that I was complaining because car dealers had the equipment to do the exact same kind of testing that DEQ did, so we wanted to be able to test the vehicles ourselves. And he said, sorry, you can't do that. The agreement that DEQ had with the EPA was that you couldn't have private proper or private businesses doing the testing. And so we were a little frustrated, and he said, but I got a better idea. He says, why don't we put some of the equipment on a Winnebago, and we'll just start driving around to the dealerships and test it for you. And he said, the way we'll pay for it is we'll charge car dealers that use this service an extra $5 per car. That'll cover our staff time, and that will cover the cost of the vehicle and the uploading the vehicle or whatever expression you want to use. And so it was a win for us. We were more than happy to pay the extra money because it was less than we were paying our employees to go back and forth. We took literally thousands of cars off the road every year, and we got the testing done, and it was a win-win for everybody. And time again, DEQ finds ways to get their mandate done in a way that makes sense both for government and for business. And this permitting process that they discussed in Senate Bill 103 is just another great example of them coming up with a program that works for everybody. And so we appreciate that, and we're excited about the bill. With me is Bob Anderson, who's the president of our board, and he'll discuss his work on the bill as well.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Fuller. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder and committee. My name is Bob Anderson, and I own an auto repair facility here in Salem, Oregon, not too far from here. And I am, as Daryl suggested, the president of the Northwest Auto Trade Association, and I co-chair the Department of Environmental Quality's Citizens Advisory Council. And I am here today to just explain briefly why our trade association supports SB 103, even though the bill's passage would generate an expense to auto repair businesses in the state that we represent. Among the many benefits that our EcoBiz shops receive, two of the benefits are really very clear. Business owners have the assurance that their business operations do not compromise health and safety issues in their community. And through the application of EcoBiz principles, they learn that going beyond regulatory environmental compliance can be made profitable in the workplace. It's these two guiding principles that allow our members or our member shops to access a largely untapped environmental marketplace. So I think briefly what I'm trying to say is environmental compliance, which we all understand is a very, very important part of what we do every day, is many times very difficult to splice into the marketplace. This EcoBiz program, which we've been working on for a number of years, helps businesses not only understand how to comply, but as I said, teaches them how to make it profitable. And when profitable environmental processes in the workplace work properly, They encourage other businesses to follow suit. Our hope with this bill is that other businesses will become EcoBiz certified.
Well, thank you. Thank you for taking time out of your work day to come here and share your thoughts with us. We really appreciate it. Any questions for this panel? Okay, and I apologize again about the oversight. And apologize for making you wait. Is there anybody else, before I drop the gavel, that would like to testify in Senate Bill 103? Come on up.
John Ledger, AOI. I thought I signed up, but I really scribbled. So it's probably lost in there, but that's great. What Mr. Ginsburg would like to do here, which is a really good idea, and it would save people money. This is an example of a federal program that has come down. The DEQ has to do it either by permitting or registration. Registration is clearly the most efficient and cost-effective way to do it. So there are probably other programs where this would apply to and actually be pretty efficient. So it's a good idea. I think the sole, what I gather, problem here really is that the way the statute's written, it talks about any air contaminant. And when you go back and look in the statute, the definition of things that emit air contaminants or anything that emits fumes, pollen, odors, particulate, smoke. So it's anything in the world, really. And I think it would be a fairly easy wordsmithing thing to narrow the bill down to give people a sense of comfort and still allow the DEQ to use this mechanism, which is a pretty efficient, good mechanism. And I think everybody would feel much more comfortable, and it would be something that they could use. So it's true, like, if they used it in some cases, it would come back through ways and means. But some of this stuff really would be substantive and should come back in some cases through a policy committee, in many cases not. But I think it would be very easy to put in language that so it just doesn't include everything in the universe, but still get enough to make this thing work well, because it's a good idea.
Thank you. Appreciate your comments. Any questions, Mr. Ledger? Okay, great. Anybody else that would like to testify on 103? Okay, and with that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 103, and I'm going to open up a work session. Beth, if you can just briefly provide us with an overview of the potential bills for committee introduction.
So there's three bills in front of you today. The first, LC 352, dated 10-28-08, eliminates option and destination resorts development in eastern Oregon of guaranteeing construction of overnight lodging. In addition, it would require actual construction of overnight units prior to sale of individual homes, units, or lots. So that's the first. LC 1182, dated 10-24-08, establishes a moratorium on approval of permits for development of destination resorts. Provides that destination resorts are not residential use for real property for purpose of limiting legal basis for claiming compensation for regulations restricting the use of property. The third and final LC for us today is LC 1633, dated 12-12-08, and it establishes additional requirements for destination resorts in eastern Washington.
Oregon.
Eastern Oregon,
that's
sorry.
Okay. Just so you know, Beth came to us from the Washington legislature, but, you know, I've been known, yes, too. But we actually can't pass laws that affect Washington land use.
Question, Madam Chair?
Sure.
The genesis of these three? I mean,
The genesis is a concern about destination resorts, and we had discussions, as you remember, last session about it. So there's been some discussion about tweaking some parts of it.
Okay.
So, and one thing I'm just going to say is, as far as the committee bill, if you're voting for a committee introduction of a committee bill, certainly doesn't mean that you support the legislation. We're going to have public hearings on these, so certainly want to make sure that's on the record. Okay. Question.
Madam Chair, out of courtesy, I move we adopt LC 352, 1633, and 1182 as committee bills, and I'd like to speak to my motion, Madam Chair.
Okay. So there's a motion. Senator Boquist moves that the following LCs be introduced as committee bill, LC 352, dated 10-28-08, LC 1182, dated 10-24-08, and LC 1633 dated 12-12-08. Is there any discussion? Senator Boquist.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, these aren't surprises. The issues aren't surprises. As I said, I would probably be a no vote on all three, but I suppose I'd rather have them in this committee than elsewhere.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that. Representative House, do you want any comments?
I support the motion, and it doesn't, you know, the vote here doesn't imply any support one way or another. I know we're going to be talking about these things.
Yeah. Right. We're going to be having a discussion about destination resorts, and so this, I have a feeling going to be a range of options. This is some of the options that may be coming our way.
Yes, Madam Chair. Okay.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. So with that, any objections? Seeing none. The measures are introduced as committee bills. Thank you. And with that, I will close the public work session. And I will close the public hearings or our meeting on the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. And we'll see you next week. And just a reminder that we may be going late next Tuesday. So so we are going to be reminding your staff. So if you do have to leave, we understand, but if you could make arrangements to stay late, we will certainly try to be as efficient as possible, but it may take more than our usual committee time. Great. Thank you.